They all shouldn't.
Loath as he was to disappoint her, Tyrion had to point out that while Lady Tanda was by no means a clever woman, even she might wonder if her daughter's bedmaid seemed to own more jewelry than her daughter. "Choose two or three dresses, no more," he commanded her. "Good wool, no silk, no samite, and no fur. The rest I'll keep in my own chambers for when you visit me." It was not the answer Shay had wanted, but at least she was safe. When the investiture was finally done, Joffrey marched out between Sir Balon and Sir Osmond in their new white cloaks, while Tyrion lingered for a word with the new High Septon, who was his choice and wise enough to know who'd put the honey on his bread. "I want the guards on our side," Tyrion told him bluntly. "Tell them that Stannis has vowed to burn the great sept of Baelor."
"Is it true, my lord?"
asked the High Septon, a small, shrewd man with a wispy white beard and wizened face. Tyrion shrugged.
"It may be. Stannis burned the god's wood at Storm's End as an offering to the Lord of Light. If he'd offend the old gods, why should he spare the new? Tell them that. Tell them that any man who thinks to give aid to the usurper betrays the gods as well as his rightful king."
I shall, my lord, and I shall command them to pray for the health of the king and his hand as well."
Halin the pyromancer was waiting on him when Tyrion returned to Isola, and Maester Frankin had brought messages. He let the alchemist wait a little longer while he read what the ravens had brought him. There was an old letter from Dorin Martell, warning him that Storm's End had fallen, and a much more intriguing one from Balon Greyjoy on Pike, who styled himself King of the Isles and the North. He invited King Joffrey to send an envoy to the Iron Islands to fix the borders between their realms and discuss a possible alliance. Tyrion read the letter three times and set it aside. Lord Balon's longships would have been a great help against the fleet sailing up from Storm's End, but they were thousands of leagues away on the wrong side of Westeros, and Tyrion was far from certain that he wanted to give way half the realm.
"Perhaps I should spill this one in Cersei's lap, or take it to the council."
Only then did he admit Halen with the latest tallies from the alchemists.
"This cannot be true," said Tyrion, as he pored over the ledgers. "Almost 13,000 jars? Do you take me for a fool? I'm not about to pay the king's gold for empty jars and pots of sewage sealed with wax, I warn you."
"No, no," Halen squeaked. "The sums are accurate, I swear. We have been most fortunate, my lord hand. Another cache of Lord Rossart's was found. More than 300 jars under the dragon pit. Some whores have been using the ruins to entertain their patrons, and one of them fell through a patch of rutted floor into a cellar. When he felt the jars, he mistook them for wine. He was so drunk, he broke the seal and drank some."
"There was a prince who tried that once," said Tyrion dryly. "I haven't seen any dragons rising over the city, so it would seem it didn't work this time either."
The dragon pit atop the Hill of Rhaenys had been abandoned for a century and a half. He supposed it was as good a place as any to store a wildfire, and better than most. But it would have been nice if the late Lord Rossart had told someone.
300 jars, you say.
That still does not account for these totals. You are several thousand jars ahead of the best estimate you gave me when we last met.
Yes, yes, that's so.
Halen mopped his pale brow with the sleeve of his black and scarlet robe.
We have been working very hard, my lord, and
That would doubtless explain why you are making so much more of the substance than before.
Smiling, Tyrion fixed the pyromancer with his mismatched stare.
Though it does raise the question of why you did not begin working hard until now.
Halen had the complexion of a mushroom, so it was hard to see how he could turn any paler, yet somehow he managed.
We were, my lord hand, my brothers and I have been labouring day and night from the first, I assure you. It's only, we have made so much of the substance that we have become more practised, as it were, and also...
The alchemist shifted uncomfortably.
Certain spells, ancient secrets of our order, very delicate, very troublesome, but necessary if the substance is to be all it should be.
Tyrion was growing impatient. Sir Jaslyn Bywater was likely here by now, and Iron Hand misliked waiting.
Yes, you have secret spells. How splendid. What of them?
They seem to be working better than they were.
Halen smiled weakly.
You don't suppose there are any dragons about, do you?
Not unless you found one under the dragon pit. Why?
Oh, pardon, I was just remembering something old Wisdom Politor told me once when I was an acolyte. I asked him why so many of our spells seemed, well, not as effectual as the scrolls would have us believe. And he said it was because magic had begun to go out of the world the day the last dragon died.
Sorry to disappoint you, but I've seen no dragons. I have noticed the King's Justice lurking about, however. Should any of these fruits you're selling me turn out to be filled with anything but wildfire, you'll be seeing him as well.
Halen fled so quickly that he almost bowled over Sir Jaslyn. No, Lord Jaslyn. You must remember that. Ironhand was mercifully direct as ever. He'd returned from Rosby to deliver a fresh levy of spearmen recruited from Lord Giles' estates and resume his command of the city watch. How does my nephew fare? Tyrion asked when they were done discussing the city's defences.
Prince Tommen is hale and happy, my lord. He has adopted a fawn some of my men brought home from a hunt. He had one once before, he says, but Joffrey skinned her for a jerkin. He asks about his mother sometimes, and often begins letters to Princess Marcella, though he never seems to finish any. His brother, however, he does not seem to miss at all.
You have made suitable arrangements for him, should the battle be lost?
My men have their instructions.
Which are?
You commanded me to tell no one, my lord.
That made him smile.
I'm pleased you remember.
Should King's Landing fall, he might well be taken alive. Better if he did not know where Joffrey's heir might be found. Varys appeared not long after Lord Jaslyn had left.
Men are such faithless creatures, he said by way of greeting.
Tyrion sighed. Who's the traitor today? The eunuch handed him a scroll.
So much villainy. It sings a sad song for our age. Did honor die with our fathers?
My father is not dead yet. Tyrion scanned the list. I know some of these names. These are rich men, traders, merchants, craftsmen. Why should they conspire against us?
It seems they believe that Lord Stannis must win and wish to share his victory. They call themselves the Entler Men, after the Crown Stag.
Someone should tell them that Stannis changed his sigil. Then they can be the Hot Hearts.
It was no matter for jest, though. It appeared that these Entler Men had armed several hundred followers to seize the old gate once battle was joined, and admit the enemy to the city. Among the names on the list was the master armorer, Sir Lorien.
Oh, I suppose this means I won't be getting that terrifying helm with the demon horns,
Tyrion complained as he scrawled the order for the man's arrest. Theon. One moment he was asleep, the next awake. Kyra nestled against him, one arm draped lightly over his, her breast brushing his back. He could hear her breathing, soft and steady. The sheet was tangled about them. It was the black of night. The bedchamber was dark and still.
What is it? Did I hear something? Someone?
Wind sighed faintly against the shutters. Somewhere far off he heard the yowl of a cat in heat. Nothing else. Sleep. Greyjoy, he told himself. The castle is quiet. You have guards posted. At your door, at the gates, on the armory. He might have put it down to a bad dream, but he did not remember dreaming. Kyra had worn him out. Until Theon had sent for her, she had lived all her 18 years in the winter town without ever setting foot inside the walls of a castle. She came to him wet and eager and lithe as a weasel, and there had been a certain undeniable spice to fucking a common tavern wench in Lord Eddard Stark's own bed. She murmured sleepily as Theon slid out from under her arm and got to his feet. A few embers still smoldered in the hearth. Wex slept on the floor at the foot of the bed, rolled up inside his cloak and dead to the world. Nothing moved. Theon crossed to the window and threw open the shutters. Night touched him with cold fingers, and goose prickles froze on his bare skin. He leaned against the stone sill and looked out on the dark towers, empty yards, black sky, and more stars than a man could ever count if he lived to be 100. A half-moon floated above the bell tower and cast its reflection on the roof of the glass gardens. He heard no alarums, no voices, not so much as a footfall. All's well, Greyjoy. Hear the quiet. You ought to be drunk with joy. You took Winterfell with fewer than 30 men, a feat to sing of. Theon started back to bed. He'd roll Kyra on her back and fuck her again. That ought to banish these phantoms. Her gasps and giggles would make a welcome respite from this silence. He stopped. He had grown so used to the howling of the direwolves that he scarcely heard it anymore. But some part of him, some hunter's instinct, heard its absence. Erzin stood outside his door, a sinewy man with a round shield slung over his back. The wolves are quiet, Theon told him. Go see what they're doing, and come straight back. The thought of the direwolves running loose gave him a queasy feeling. He remembered the day in the wolf's wood when the wildlings had attacked Bran. Summer and Grey Wind had torn them to pieces. When he prodded Wex with the toe of his boot, the boy sat up and rubbed his eyes. Make certain Bran Stark and his little brother are in their beds, and be quick about it. My lord, Kyra called sleepily. Go back to sleep. This does not concern you. Theon poured himself a cup of wine and drank it down. All the time he was listening, hoping to hear a howl. Too few men, he thought sourly. I have too few men. If Asher does not come. Wex returned the quickest, shaking his head from side to side. Cursing, Theon found his tunic and breeches on the floor where he had dropped them in his haste to get at Kyra. Over the tunic he donned a jerkin of iron-studded leather, and he belted a long sword and dagger at his waist. His hair was wild as the wood, but he had larger concerns. By then Erzin was back. The wolves be gone. Theon told himself he must be as cold and deliberate as Lord Eddard. Rouse the castle, he said. Herd them out into the yard, everyone. We'll see who's missing. And have Lauren make a round of the gates. Wex, with me. He wondered if Stig had reached Deepwood Mott yet. The man was not as skilled a rider as he claimed. None of the Iron Men were much good in the saddle. But there had been time enough. Asher might well be on her way. And if she learns that I have lost the Starks, it did not bear thinking about. Bran's bedchamber was empty, as was Rickon's half a turn below. Theon cursed himself. He should have kept a guard on them, but he deemed it more important to have men walking the walls and protecting the gates than to nursemaid a couple of children, one a cripple. Outside he heard sobbing as the castle folk were pulled from their beds and driven into the yard. I'll give them reason to sob. I've used them gently, and this is how they repay me. He'd even had two of his own men whipped bloody for raping the kennel girl to show them he meant to be just. They still blame me for the rape, though, and the rest. He deemed that unfair. Micken had killed himself with his mouth, just as Benfred had. As for Shale, he had to give someone to the drowned guard. His men expected it. "I bear you no ill will," he told the Septon, before they threw him down the well. "But you and your guards have no place here now." You'd think the others would be grateful he hadn't chosen one of them, but no. He wondered how many of them were part of this plot against him. Erzin returned with Black Lauren. "The Hunter's Gate," Lauren said. "Best come see." The Hunter's Gate was conveniently sited close to the kennels and kitchens. It opened directly on fields and forests, allowing riders to come and go without first passing through the winter town, and so was favored by hunting parties. "Who had the guard here?" Theon demanded. "Drennan and Squint." Drennan was one of the men who'd raped Parla. "If they let the boys escape, I'll have more than a little skin off their backs this time. I swear it." "No need for that," Black Lauren said curtly. Nor was there. They found Squint floating face down in the moat, his entrails drifting behind him like a nest of pale snakes. Drennan lay half naked in the gatehouse, in the snug room where the drawbridge was worked. His throat had been open ear to ear. A ragged tunic concealed the half-heel scars on his back, but his boots were scattered amidst the rushes, and his breeches tangled about his feet. There was cheese on a small table near the door, beside an empty flagon and two cups. Theon picked one up and sniffed at the dregs of wine in the bottom. "Squint was up on the wall walk, no?" "Aye," said Lauren. Theon flung the cup into the hearth. "I'd say Drennan was pulling down his breeches to stick it in the woman when she stuck it in him. His own cheese knife, by the look of it. Someone find a pike and fish the other fool out of the moat." The other fool was in a deal worse shape than Drennan when Black Lauren drew him out of the water. They saw that one of his arms had been wrenched off at the elbow. Half of his neck was missing, and there was a ragged hole where his navel and groin had once been. The pike tore through his bowels as Lauren was pulling him in. The stench was awful. "The direwolves," Theon said. "Both of them, at a guess." Disgusted, he walked back to the drawbridge. Winterfell was encircled by two massive granite walls with a wide moat between them. The outer wall stood 80 feet high, the inner more than 100. Lacking men, Theon had been forced to abandon the outer defences and post his guards along the higher inner walls. He dared not risk having them on the wrong side of the moat should the castle rise against him. There had to be two more, he decided. While the woman was entertaining Drennan, the others freed the wolves. Theon called for a torch and led them up the steps to the wall walk. He swept the flame low before him, looking for... There! On the inside of the rampart, in the wide crenel between two upthrust merlins. "Blood," he announced. "Clumsily mopped up. At a guess, the woman killed Drennan and lowered the drawbridge. Squint heard the clank of chains, came to have a look, and got this far. They pushed the corpse through the crenel into the moat so he wouldn't be found by another sentry." Erzin peered along the walls. "The other watch turrets and a fire. I see torches burning." "Torches, but no guards," Theon said testily. "Winterfell has more turrets than I have men." 4 guards at the main gate," said Black Lauren, "and 5 walking the walls beside Squint." Erzin said, "If he had sounded his horn..." "I'm served by fools." "Try and imagine it was you up there, Erzin. It's dark and cold. You have been walking sentry for hours, looking forward to the end of your watch. Then you hear a noise and you move forward to the gate, and suddenly you see eyes at the top of the stair, glowing green and gold in the torchlight. 2 shadows come rushing toward you, faster than you can believe. You catch a glimpse of teeth, start to level your spear, and they slam into you and open your belly, tearing through leather as if it was cheesecloth." He gave Erzin a hard shove. "And now you're down on your back. Your guts are spilling out, and one of them has his teeth round your neck. Theon grabbed the man's scrawny throat, tightening his fingers and smiled. Tell me, at what moment, during all of this, do you stop to blow your fucking horn? He shoved Erzin away roughly, sending him stumbling back against a merlon. The man rubbed his throat. I should have had those beasts put down the day we took the castle, he saw angrily. I'd seen them kill. I knew how dangerous they were. We must go after them, Black Lauren said. Not in the dark. Theon did not relish the idea of chasing direwolves through the wood by night. The hunters could easily become the hunted. We'll wait for daylight. Until then, I'd best go speak with my loyal subjects. Down in the yard, an uneasy crowd of men, women, and children had been pushed up against the wall. Many had not been given time to dress. They covered themselves with woolen blankets or huddled naked under cloaks or bedrobes. A dozen iron men hemmed them in, torches in one hand and weapons in the other. The wind was gusting, and the flickering orange light reflected dully off steel helms, thick beards, and unsmiling eyes. Theon walked up and down before the prisoners, studying the faces. They all looked guilty to him. How many are missing? Six. Reek stepped up behind him, smelling of soap, his long hair moving in the wind. Both Starks, that bug boy and his sister, the half-wit from the stable, and your wildling woman. Usher. He had suspected her from the moment he saw that second cup. I should have known better than to trust that one. She's as unnatural as Usher. Even their names sound alike. Has anyone had a look at the stables? Igar says no horses are missing. Dancer is still in his stall. Dancer? Reek frowned. Igar says the horses are all there. Only the half-wit is missing. They're afoot, then. That was the best news he'd heard since he woke. Bran would be riding in his basket, on Hodor's back, no doubt. Usher would need to carry Rickon. His little legs wouldn't take him far on their own. Theon was confident that he'd soon have them back in his hands. Bran and Rickon have fled, he told the castle folk, watching their eyes. Who knows where they've gone? No one answered. They could not have escaped without help, Theon went on. Without food, clothing, weapons. He'd locked away every sword and axe in Winterfell, but no doubt some had been hidden from him. I'll have the names of all those who aided them, all those who turned a blind eye. The only sound was the wind. Come first light. I mean to bring them back. He hooked his thumb through his sword belt. I need huntsmen. Who wants a nice warm wolf skin to see them through the winter? Gage? The cook had always greeted him cheerfully when he returned from the hunt to ask whether he'd brought anything choice for the table, but he had nothing to say now. Theon walked back the way he'd come, searching their faces for the least sign of guilty knowledge. The wild is no place for a cripple. And Rickon, young as he is, how long will he last out there? Nan, think how frightened he must be. The old woman had nattered at him for 10 years, telling her endless stories, but now she gaped at him as if he were some stranger. I might have killed every man of you and given your women to my soldiers for their pleasure, but instead, I protected you. Is this the thanks you offer? Joseph, who'd groomed his horses, Farlan, who taught him all he knew of hounds, Barth, the brewer's wife, who'd been his first, none of them would meet his eyes. They hate me, he realized. Reek stepped close. Strip off their skins, he urged, his thick lips glistening. Lord Bolton, he used to say, a naked man has few secrets, but a flayed man's got none. The flayed man was the sigil of House Bolton, Theon knew. Ages past, certain of their lords had gone so far as to cloak themselves in the skins of dead enemies. A number of Starks had ended thus. Supposedly, all that had stopped 1,000 years ago, when the Boltons had bent their knees to Winterfell. Or so they say, but always die hard, as well I know. There will be no flaying in the North so long as I rule in Winterfell, Theon said loudly. I am your only protection, against the likes of him. He wanted to scream. He could not be that blatant, but perhaps some of them were clever enough to take the lesson. The sky was greying over the castle walls. Dawn could not be far off. Joseph, saddle Smiler, and a horse for yourself. Murch, Garrus, Poxy Tim, you'll come as well. Murch and Garrus were the best huntsmen in the castle, and Tim was a fine bowman. Agar, Rednose, Gelmar, Reek, Wex. He needed his own to watch his back. Fardon, I want hounds, and you to handle them. The grizzled kennel master crossed his arms.
And why would I care to hunt down my own true-born lords and babes at that?
Theon moved close. I am your true-born lord now, and a man who keeps Parla safe. He saw the defiance die in Farland's eyes.
Aye, my lord.
Stepping back, Theon glanced about to see who else he might add. Maester Lewin, he announced.
I know nothing of hunting.
No, but I don't trust you in a castle in my absence. Then it's past time you learned.
Let me come too. I want that wolfskin cloak.
A boy stepped forward, no older than Bran. It took Theon a moment to remember him.
I've hunted lots of times before, Waldo Frey said. Red deer and elk and even boar.
His cousin laughed at him.
He rode on a boar hunt with his father, but they never let him near the boar.
Theon looked at the boy doubtfully.
Come if you like, but if you can't keep up, don't think that I'll nurse you along.
He turned back to Black Lauren.
Winterfell is yours in my absence. If we do not return, do with it as you will.
That bloody well ought to have them praying for my success. They assembled by the Hunter's Gate as the first pale rays of the sun brushed the top of the bell tower, their breaths frosting in the cold morning air. Gelmar had equipped himself with a long axe whose reach would allow him to strike before the wolves were on him. The blade was heavy enough to kill with a single blow. Aegar wore steel greaves. Reek arrived carrying a boar spear and an overstuffed washerwoman's sack bulging with God knows what. Theon had his bow. He needed nothing else. Once he had saved Bran's life with an arrow, he hoped he would not need to take it with another. But if it came to that, he would. 11 men, 2 boys, and a dozen dogs crossed the moat. Beyond the outer wall, the tracks were plain to read in the soft ground. The paw prints of the wolves. Hodor's heavy tread. The shallower marks left by the feet of the 2 reeds. Once under the trees, the stony ground and fallen leaves made the trail harder to see, but by then Farland's red bitch had the scent. The rest of the dogs were close behind, the hounds sniffing and barking, a pair of monstrous mastiffs bringing up the rear. Their size and ferocity might make the difference against a cornered direwolf. He'd have guessed that Usher might have run south to Sir Roderick, but the trail led north by northwest into the very heart of the Wolf's Wood. Theon did not like that one bit. It would have been a bitter irony if the Starks had made for Deepwood Mott and delivered themselves right into Asher's hands. I'd sooner have them dead, he thought bitterly. It is better to be seen as cruel than foolish. Wisps of pale mist threaded between the trees. Sentinels and soldier pines grew thicker about here, and there was nothing as dark and gloomy as an evergreen forest. The ground was uneven, and the fallen needles disguised the softness of the turf and made the footing treacherous for the horses, so they had to go slowly. Not so slowly as a man carrying a cripple, though, or a bony harridan with a 4-year-old on her back. He told himself to be patient. He'd have them before the day was out. Maester Lewin trotted up to him as they were following a game trail along the lip of a ravine.
Thus far, hunting seems indistinguishable from riding through the woods, my lord.
Theon smiled.
There are similarities, but with hunting, there's blood at the end.
Must it be so? This flight was great folly. But will you not be merciful? These are your foster brothers we seek.
No Stark but Rob was ever brotherly toward me. But Bran and Rickon have more value to me living than dead. The same is true of the Reeds. Moat Cailin sits on the edge of the bogs. Lord Howlin can make your uncle's occupation a visit to hell if he chooses. But so long as you hold his ears, he must stay his hand.
Theon had not considered that. In truth, he had scarcely considered the Mudmen at all. Beyond eyeing Mira once or twice and wondering if she was still a maiden.
You may be right. We will spare them if we can. And Hodor too, I hope. The boy is simple, you know that. He does as he's told. How many times has he groomed your horse, soaped your saddle, scoured your mail?
Hodor was nothing to him.
If he does not fight us, we will let him live. Theon pointed a finger. But say one word about sparing the wildling, and you can die with her. She swore me an oath, and pissed on it.
The maester inclined his head.
I make no apologies for oath-breakers. Do what you must. I thank you for your mercy.
Mercy, thought Theon, as Luan dropped back.
There's a bloody trap. Too much, and they call you weak. Too little, and you're monstrous.
Yet the maester had given him good counsel, he knew. His father thought only in terms of conquest, but what good was it to take a kingdom if you could not hold it? Force and fear could carry you only so far. A pity Ned Stark had taken his daughter south. Elsewise, Theon could have tightened his grip on Winterfell by marrying one of them. Sansa was a pretty little thing, too, and by now likely even ripe for bedding. But she was 1,000 leagues away, in the clutches of the Lannisters. A shame. The wood grew ever wilder. The pines and sentinels gave way to huge dark oaks. Tangles of hawthorn concealed treacherous gullies and cuts. Stony hills rose and fell. They passed a crofter's cottage, deserted and overgrown, and skirted a flooded quarry where the still water had a sheen as grey as steel. When the dogs began to bay, Theon figured the fugitives were near at hand. He spurred Smiler and followed at a trot. But what he found was only the carcass of a young elk, or what remained of it. He dismounted for a closer look. The kill was still fresh, and plainly the work of wolves. The dog sniffed around it eagerly, and one of the mastiffs buried his teeth into a haunch until Farlan shouted him off. No part of this animal has been butchered, Theon realized. The wolves ate, but not the men. Even if Usher did not want to risk a fire, she ought to have cut them a few steaks. It made no sense to leave so much good meat to rot. Farlan, are you certain we're on the right trail? He demanded. Could your dogs be chasing the wrong wolves?
My bitch knows the smell of Summer and Shaggy well enough.
I hope so, for your sake. Less than an hour later, the trail led down a slope toward a muddy brook swollen by the recent rains. It was there the dogs lost the scent. Farlan and Wex waded across with the hounds and came back shaking their heads, while the animals ranged up and down the far bank sniffing.
They went in here, my lord, but I can't see where they come out,
the kennel master said. Theon dismounted and knelt beside the stream. He dipped a hand in it. The water was cold.
They won't have stayed long in this, he said. Take off the dogs downstream. I'll go up.
Wex clapped his hands together loudly.
What is it? Theon said.
The mute boy pointed. The ground near the water was sodden and muddy. The tracks the wolves had left were plain enough.
Paw prints, yes. So?
Wex drove his heel into the mud and pivoted his foot this way and that. It left a deep gouge. Joseph understood.
A man the size of Hodor ought to have left a deep print in this mud, he said. More so with the weight of a boy on his back. Yet the only boot prints here are our own. See for yourself.
Appalled, Theon saw it was true. The wolves had gone into the turgid brown water alone.
Usher must have turned aside, back of us. Before the elk, most likely. She sent the wolves on by themselves, hoping we'd chase after them.
He rounded on his huntsman.
If you two have played me false...
There's been only the one trail, my lord. I swear it, said Garrus defensively. And the direwolves would never have parted from them boys. Not for long.
That's so, Theon thought. Summer and Shaggy Dog might have gone off to hunt, but soon or late they would return to Bran and Rickon. Garrus, Murch, take four dogs and double back. Find where we lost them. Aegar, you watch them. I'll have no trickery. Farlan and I will follow the direwolves. Give a blast on your horn when you pick up the trail. Two blasts if you catch sight of the beasts themselves. Once we find out where they went, they'll lead us back to their masters.
He took Wex, the Frey Boy, and Ginner Rednose to search upstream. He and Wex rode on one side of the brook, Rednose and Walder Frey on the other, each with a pair of hounds. The wolves might have come out on either bank. Theon kept an eye out for tracks, spoor, broken branches, any hint as to where the dire wolves might have left the water. He spied the prints of deer, elk, and badger easily enough. Wex surprised a vixen drinking at the stream, and Walder flushed three rabbits from the underbrush and managed to put an arrow in one. They saw the claw marks where a bear had shredded the bark of a tall birch, but of the dire wolves there was no sign.
A little farther, Theon told himself. Past that oak, over that rise, past the next bend of the stream, we'll find something there.
He pressed on, long after he knew he should turn back, a growing sense of anxiety gnawing at his belly. It was midday when he wrenched Smiler's head around in disgust and gave up. Somehow, Usher and the wretched boys were eluding him. It should not have been possible, not on foot, burdened with a cripple and a young child. Every passing hour increased the likelihood that they would make good their escape. If they reach a village, the people of the north would never deny Ned Stark's sons, Robb's brothers. They'd have mounts to speed them on their way, food. Men would fight for the honor of protecting them. The whole bloody north would rally around them. The wolves went downstream, that's all. He clung to the thought. That red bitch will sniff where they came out of the water and will be after them again. But when they joined up with Farland's party, one look at the kennel master's face smashed all of Theon's hopes to shards. The only thing those dogs are fit for is a bear baiting, he said angrily. Would that I had a bear. The dogs are not at fault. Farland knelt between a mastiff and his precious red bitch, a hand on each. Running water don't hold no sense, my lord. The wolves had to come out of the stream somewhere. No doubt they did, upstream or down. We keep on. We'll find the place, but which way? I never knew a wolf to run up a stream bed for miles, said Reek. A man might, if he knew he was being hunted. He might. But a wolf?
Yet Theon wondered. These beasts were not as other wolves. I should have skinned the cursed things. It was the same tale all over again when they rejoined Garrus, Murch, and Aegar. The huntsmen had retraced their steps halfway to Winterfell without finding any sign of where the Starks might have parted company with the direwolves. Farlan's hounds seemed as frustrated as their masters, sniffing forlornly at trees and rocks and snapping irritably at each other. Theon dared not admit defeat.
We'll return to the brook. Search again. This time, we'll go as far as we must.
We won't find them, the Frey Boy said suddenly. Not so long as the Frog Eaters are with them. Mudmen are sneaks. They won't fight like decent folk. They'll skulk and use poison arrows. You never see them, but they see you. Those who go into the bogs after them get lost and never come out. Their houses move. Even the castles like Greywater Watch.
He glanced nervously at greenery that encircled them on all sides.
They might be out there right now, listening to everything we say.
Farden laughed to show what he thought of that notion.
Oh, my dogs would smell anything in them bushes. Be all over them before you could break wind, boy.
Frog eaters don't smell like men, Frey insisted. They have a buggy stink. like frogs and trees and scummy water. Moss grows under their arms in place of air, and they can live with nothing to eat but mud and breathe swamp water.
Theon was about to tell him what he ought to do with his wet nurse's fibble when Maester Lewin spoke up.
The histories say the Crannog men who grew close to the children of the forest in the days when the green seers tried to bring the hammer of the waters down upon the neck. It may be they have secret knowledge.
Suddenly, the wood seemed a deal darker than it had a moment before, as if a cloud had passed before the sun. It was one thing to have some fool boy spouting folly, but maesters were supposed to be wise. The only children that concern me are Bran and Rickon, Theon said. Back to the stream, now. For a moment, he did not think they were going to obey, but in the end, old habit asserted itself. They followed sullenly, but they followed. The Frey boy was as jumpy as those rabbits he'd flushed earlier. Theon put men on either bank and followed the current. They rode for miles, going slow and careful, dismounting to lead the horses over treacherous ground, letting the good-for-bear-bait hounds sniff at every bush. Where a fallen tree dammed the flow, the hunters were forced to loop around a deep green pool. But if the direwolves had done the same, they'd left neither print nor spore. The beasts had taken to swimming, it seemed. When I catch them, they'll have all the swimming they can stomach. I'll give them both to the drowned god. When the woods began to darken, Theon Greyjoy knew he was beaten. Either the Crannog men did know the magic of the children of the forest, or else Usher had deceived them with some wilding trick. He made them press on through the dusk, but when the last light faded, Joseph finally worked up the courage to say, "This is fruitless, my lord. We will lame a horse, break a leg."
Joseph has the right of it, said Maester Lewin. Groping through the woods by torchlight will avail us nothing.
Theon could taste bile at the back of his throat, and his stomach was a nest of snakes twining and snapping at each other. If he crept back to Winterfell empty-handed, he might as well dress in motley henceforth and wear a pointed hat. The whole North would know him for a fool. And when my father hears, an usher.
My lord prince,
Reek urged his horse near.
Might be them Starks never came this way. If I was them, I would have gone north and east, maybe, to the Umbers. Good Stark men they are. But their lands are a long way. The boys would shelter someplace nearer. Might be, I know where.
Theon looked at him suspiciously. Tell me.
You know that old mill, sitting lonely on the Acorn Water? We stopped there when I was being dragged to Winterfell a captive. The miller's wife sold us hay for our horses, while that old knight clucked over her brats. Might be the Starks ride in there.
Theon knew the mill. He had even tumbled the miller's wife a time or two. There was nothing special about it, or her. Why there? There are a dozen villages and Holdfast just as close. Amusement shone in those pale eyes.
Why? Now that's past knowing. But they're there. I've a feeling.
He was growing sick of this man's sly answers.
His lips look like two worms fucking.
What are you saying? If you've kept some knowledge from me.
My lord prince,
Reek dismounted and beckoned Theon to do the same. When they were both afoot, he pulled open the cloth sack he'd fetched from Winterfell.
Have a look here.
It was growing hard to see. Theon thrust his hand into the sack impatiently, groping amongst soft fur and rough, scratchy wool. A sharp point pricked his skin, and his fingers closed around something cold and hard. He drew out a wolf's head brooch, silver and jet.
Understanding came suddenly.
His hand closed into a fist.
Gelmar,
he said, wondering whom he could trust.
None of them. Aegar, Red Nose, with us. The rest of you may return to Winterfell with the hounds.
I have no further need of them. I know where Bran and Rickon are hiding now.
Prince Theon, Maester Luwin entreated, you will remember your promise. Mercy, you said.
Mercy was for this morning, said Theon.
It is better to be feared than laughed at.
Before they made me angry.
John. They could see the fire in the night, glimmering against the side of the mountain like a fallen star. It burned redder than the other stars and did not twinkle, though sometimes it flared up bright and sometimes dwindled down to no more than a distant spark, dull and faint. Half a mile ahead and 2,000 feet up, John judged, and perfectly placed to see anything moving in the pass below.
Watchers in a Skirlin Pass,
wondered the oldest among them. In the spring of his youth, he had been a squire to a king, so the Black Brother still called him Squire Dalbridge.
What is it Mance Rayder fears, I wonder?
If he knew they'd lit a fire, he'd flay the poor bastards, said Eben, a squat bald man, muscled like a bag of rocks.
Fire is life up here, said Corrin Halfhand, but it can be death as well.
By his command, they'd risked no open flame since entering the mountains. They ate cold salt beef, hard bread, and harder cheese, and they slept clothed and huddled beneath a pile of cloaks and furs, grateful for each other's warmth. It made John remember cold nights long ago at Winterfell, when he'd shared a bed with his brothers. These men were brothers, too, though the bed they shared was stone and earth.
"They'll have a horn," said Stone Snake. The half-hand said, "A horn they must not blow."
"That's a long, cruel climb by night," Eben said, as he eyed the distant spark through a cleft in the rocks that sheltered them. The sky was cloudless, the jagged mountains rising black on black until the very top, where their cold crowns of snow and ice shone palely in the moonlight.
"And a longer fall," said Corrin Halfhand. "Two men, I think. They are like to be two up there, sharing the watch."
"Me." The ranger called Stone Snake had already shown that he was the best climber among them. It would have to be him.
"And me," said Jon Snow.
Corrin Halfhand looked at him. John could hear the wind keening as it shivered through the high pass above them. One of the Garrons wickered and pawed at the thin stony soil of the hollow where they had taken shelter.
"The wolf will remain with us," Corrin said. "White fur is seen too easily by moonlight."
He turned to Stone Snake.
"When it's done, throw down a burning brand. We'll come when we see it fall."
"No better time to start than now," said Stone Snake. They each took a long coil of rope. Stone Snake carried a bag of iron spikes as well and a small hammer with its head wrapped in thick felt. Their garrons they left behind, along with their helms, mail, and ghost. John knelt and let the dire wolf nuzzle him before they set off.
"Stay," he commanded. "I'll be back for you."
Stone Snake took the lead. He was a short, wiry man, near 50 and grey of beard, but stronger than he seemed. And he had the best night eyes of anyone John had ever known. He needed them tonight. By day, the mountains were a blue-grey, brushed with frost. But once the sun vanished behind the jagged peaks, they turned black. Now the rising moon had limned them in white and silver. The Black Brothers moved through black shadows amidst black rocks, working their way up a steep, twisting trail as their breath frosted in the black air. John felt almost naked without his mail, but he did not miss its weight. This was hard going and slow. To hurry here was to risk a broken ankle or worse. Stone Snake seemed to know where to put his feet as if by instinct, but John needed to be more careful on the broken, uneven ground. The Skirling Pass was really a series of passes, a long twisting course that went up around a succession of icy, wind-carved peaks and down through hidden valleys that seldom saw the sun. Apart from his companions, John had glimpsed no living man since they'd left the wood behind and begun to make their way upward.
The Frostfangs were as cruel as any place the gods had made, and as inimical to men. The wind cut like a knife up here, and shrilled in the night like a mother mourning her slain children. What few trees they saw were stunted, grotesque things growing sideways out of cracks and fissures. Tumbled shelves of rock often overhung the trail, fringed with hanging icicles that looked like long white teeth from a distance. Yet even so, Jon Snow was not sorry he had come. There were wonders here as well. He had seen sunlight flashing on icy thin waterfalls as they plunged over the lips of sheer stone cliffs, and a mountain meadow full of autumn wildflowers, blue coal snaps and bright scarlet frost fires, and stands of piper's grass in russet and gold. He had peered down ravines so deep and black they seemed certain to end in some hell, and he had ridden his iron over a wind-eaten bridge of natural stone with nothing but sky to either side. Eagles nested in the heights and came down to hunt the valleys, circling effortlessly on great blue-gray wings that seemed almost part of the sky. Once he had watched a shadow cat stalk a ram, flowing down the mountainside like liquid smoke until it was ready to pounce. Now it is our turn to pounce. He wished he could move as sure and silent as that shadow cat and kill as quickly. Longclaw was sheathed across his back, but he might not have room to use it. He carried dirk and dagger for closer work. They will have weapons as well, and I am not armored. He wondered who would prove the shadow cat by night's end and who the ram. For a long way they stayed to the trail, following its twists and turns as it snaked along the side of the mountain, upward, ever upward. Sometimes the mountain folded back on itself, and they lost sight of the fire, but soon or late it would always reappear. The path Stone Snake chose would never have served for the horses. In places, John had to put his back to the cold stone and shuffle along sideways like a crab, inch by inch. Even where the track widened, it was treacherous. There were cracks big enough to swallow a man's leg, rubble to stumble over, hollow places where the water pooled by day and froze hard by night. One step and then another, John told himself. One step and then another, and I will not fall. He had not shaved since leaving the Fist of the First Men, and the hair on his lip was soon stiff with frost. 2 hours into the climb, the wind kicked up so fiercely that it was all he could do to hunch down and cling to the rock, praying he would not be blown off the mountain. One step and then another. He resumed when the gale subsided. One step and then another. I will not fall. Soon they were high enough so that looking down was best not considered. There was nothing below but yawning blackness, nothing above but moon and stars. The mountain is your mother, Stone Snake had told him during an easier climb a few days past. Cling to her, press your face against her tits, and she won't drop you. John had made a joke of it, saying how he always wondered who his mother was, but never thought to find her in the Frostfangs. It did not seem nearly so amusing now. One step, and then another, he thought, clinging tight. The narrow track ended abruptly, where a massive shoulder of black granite thrust out from the side of the mountain. After the bright moonlight, its shadow was so black that it felt like stepping into a cave. Straight up here, the ranger said in a quiet voice. We want to get above them. He peeled off his gloves, tucked them through his belt, tied one end of his rope around his waist, the other end around John. Follow me when the rope grows taut. The ranger did not wait for an answer, but started at once, moving upward with fingers and feet faster than John would have believed. The long rope unwound slowly. John watched him closely, making note of how he went and where he found each handhold. And when the last loop of hemp uncoiled, he took off his own gloves and followed, much more slowly. Stone Snake had passed the rope around the smooth spike of rock he was waiting on, but as soon as John reached him, he shook it loose and was off again. This time there was no convenient cleft when he reached the end of their tether, so he took out his felt-headed hammer and drove a spike deep into a crack in the stone with a series of gentle taps. Soft as the sounds were, they echoed off the stone so loudly that John winced with every blow, certain that the wildlings must have heard them too. When the spike was secure, Stone Snake secured the rope to it, and John started after him. "Suck on the mountain's tit," he reminded himself. "Don't look down. Keep your weight above your feet. Don't look down. Look at the rock in front of you. There's a good handhold. Yes, don't look down. I can catch a breath on that ledge there. All I need to do is reach it. Never look down." Once his foot slipped as he put his weight on it, and his heart stopped in his chest. But the guards were good, and he did not fall. He could feel the cold seeping off the rock into his fingers, but he dared not don his gloves. Gloves would slip, no matter how tight they seemed. Cloth and fur, moving between skin and stone, and up here, that could kill him. His burned hand was stiffening up on him, and soon it began to ache. Then he ripped open his thumbnail somehow, and after that he left smears of blood wherever he put his hand. He hoped he still had all his fingers by the end of the climb. Up they went, and up and up, black shadows creeping across the moonlit wall of rock. Anyone down on the floor of the pass could have seen them easily, but the mountain hid them from the view of the wildlings by their fire. They were close now, though. John could sense it. Even so, he did not think of the foes who were waiting for him, all unknowing, but of his brother at Winterfell. "Bran used to love to climb. I wish I had a tenth part of his courage." The wall was broken 2/3 of the way up by a crooked fissure of icy stone. Stone Snake reached down a hand to help him up. He had donned his gloves again, so John did the same. The ranger moved his head to the left, and the two of them crawled along the shelf, 300 yards or more, until they could see the dull orange glow beyond the lip of the cliff. The wildlings had built their watchfire in a shallow depression above the narrowest part of the pass, with a sheer drop below and rock behind to shelter them from the worst of the wind. The same windbreak allowed the Black Brothers to crawl within a few feet of them, creeping along on their bellies until they were looking down on the men they must kill. One was asleep, curled up tight and buried beneath a great mound of skins. John could see nothing of him but his hair, bright red in the firelight. The second sat close to the flames, feeding them twigs and branches and complaining of the wind in a querulous tone. The third watched the pass, though there was little to see, only a vast bowl of darkness ringed by the snowy shoulders of the mountains. It was the watcher who wore the horn. Three. For a moment, John was uncertain. There were only supposed to be two. One was asleep, though. And whether there was two or three or 20, he still must do what he had come to do. Stone Snake touched his arm, pointed at the wildling with the horn. John nodded toward the one by the fire. It felt queer, picking a man to kill. Half the days of his life had been spent with sword and shield, training for this moment. Did Rob feel this way before his first battle? He wondered, but there was no time to ponder the question. Stone Snake moved as fast as his namesake, leaping down on the wildlings in a rain of pebbles. John slid Longclaw from his sheath and followed. It all seemed to happen in a heartbeat. Afterward, John could admire the courage of the wildling, who reached first for his horn instead of his blade. He got it to his lips, but before he could sound it, Stone Snake knocked the horn aside with a swipe of his short sword. John's man leapt to his feet, thrusting at his face with a burning brand. He could feel the heat of the flames as he flinched back. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the sleeper stirring and knew he must finish his man quick. When the brand swung again, he bulled into it, swinging the bastard sword with both hands. The Valyrian steel sheared through leather, fur, wool, and flesh. But when the wildling fell, he twisted, ripping the sword from John's grasp. On the ground, the sleeper sat up beneath his furs. John slid his dirk free, grabbing the man by the hair and jamming the point of the knife up under his chin as he reached for his... No. Her. His hand froze. A girl? A watcher, said Stone Snake. A wildling. Finish her.
John could see fear and fire in her eyes.